Interview with David Sirignano, February 25th, 2008, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr. I want to start with a little bit of background and find out when you developed your interest in securities law. Was it while you were in college? Is it something you thought you'd go into?
Probably pretty late in my law school career. If I had a focus on law school, it was probably in labor law more than securities law. I did an internship, I guess, after my second year of law school down in the Southern District of New York, working with the assistant U.S. attorneys. And I just loved the work they were doing and the responsibility they gave young attorneys. And so when I asked them, how do you do this? They said, well, sorry, the U.S. attorneys don't hire out of law school. But the SEC is a very similar experience, a great place to work. Go talk to the SEC. So I loaded up on securities courses in my third year, applied to the SEC, and went there. Went into the general counsel's office.
So was it the public service angle that interested you?
Yeah, definitely. I had a bit of a family history of that. My dad was a government lawyer for most of his career in New York City. So that somewhat appealed to me. He was both in the Manhattan DA's office and the Waterfront Commission of New York Harbor, fighting organized crime on the docks.
Okay. So that might have had something to do with your early interest in labor law, I guess.
A bit, yeah.
So did any of that labor law training translate over to the securities world?
Not a whole lot. Not a whole lot.
Well, tell me about what you found in the general counsel's office when you came down. Who hired you?
I was hired by Harvey Pitt, but my first day there was Ralph Ferrara's first day there as general counsel. I worked under Jake Stillman, I was still there, doing appellate litigation, and it was just the best training a young lawyer could possibly have to develop legal skills, legal reasoning, legal writing, legal research. And it's all everything I expected in terms of, immediate responsibility. Within a year, I was arguing cases before federal courts of appeals. So it was just a terrific experience. Plus, the work they do is great anyway, because it's by nature appellate. So you get to focus more on the legal than the fact and discovery part of litigation practice. A good deal of it is amicus practice. So by definition, if it doesn't sound cool to you, you don't do it.
Wasn't a decision you got to make.
No, the commission made all those decisions. But by definition, we were just doing cutting-edge work.
Well, what were some of those cutting-edge cases you were working on?
I did quite a bit of Williams Act work, which would be significant to the second step of my SEC career, both in terms of private right of actions under the Williams Act, Section 13D, private right of actions, as well as available remedies for violations of 13D, which was a big issue back then. That's when hostile tender offers were heating up in the Boesky-Milken days, and issuers are trying to defend against what they saw as ramping up illegally in their stock by not making adequate disclosure, by bringing 13D suits and trying to get disgorgement of the shares or prevent the voting of the shares or somehow block a takeover because of 13D violations. Constitutionality preemption issues when the states started adopting takeover statutes that the commission came out, that was during the Reagan years, and said, no, they're preempted by the Williams Act. Essentially fought back most of the defensive-style statutes that were adopted in the 1970s, early 80s.
So you were involved in taking a look at those and essentially finding that they were going too far?
Yeah, and arguing in court the preemption theories as amicus.
What were the preemption theories?
That was inconsistent with the neutrality of the Williams Act, particularly the statutes that require a hearing before you can launch a takeover for Pennsylvania Corporation or Ohio Corporation or Virginia Corporation.
Was the Williams Act mostly about tender offers?
Yeah, it covers both the formal tender offer process as well as the rapid acquisition of shares and under the 13D beneficial ownership reporting.
So how did you handle those cases? Did Ferrara just divide them up and say, this is yours, and then you report back later? Did you work on teams?
I would work on a team. You know, as a young attorney, I would be the first line person responsible for the research and drafting. Eventually, and then those would normally get argued by somebody else. Eventually, I think by the time three years or so, I was assistant general counsel, GS-15, and I was running teams and arguing cases. I think I spent 8 years doing that kind of work. And I'd say most of the cases where I had a focus, it was on the Williams Act cases. Huh. But I did other things. One of my favorite cases was one we lost in the Supreme Court, which was the SEC versus Lowe case. Because the SEC used to require newsletter publishers to register as investment advisors. We defended that all the way to the Supreme Court and lost. Huh. But it was a great victory for the First Amendment.
Did this have to do with insider trading at all? This idea that the publishers had to publisher knowledge.
A specialized type of insider trading where people put out these tip sheets, you know, knowing that there's really nothing going on, which you generate a lot of interest in the market, and as soon as the market got excited, they would sell out. So the tipping sheets was the reason Congress and the SEC said we need to regulate this, but the Supreme Court didn't buy that.
Now, at this point, you're in the general counsel's office.
Right.
You talked about having teams. I never got the sense the general counsel's office was that large. About how many people?
Well, it grew under Ralph Ferrara. But it grew more on the regulatory side. It essentially added the function of being a second voice, an overseer of all the operating divisions in their proposals to the commission, particularly enforcement. Chairman Williams wanted a strong general counsel to have a second opinion on enforcement recommendations coming out of Sorkin's enforcement staff, and Ralph, who was in general counsel, was in enforcement, was a counsel to the chairman, got promoted to general counsel when Harvey left, and that's the office he built. And I did a little bit of that as well, advising on regulatory proposals and matters, but my focus was on the appellate side. Jake Stillman headed that group, and there were about, I think, three assistant general counsels working for him, so about three appellate teams.
Okay.
Doing it.
So how much would the people in the divisions work with you when you're doing your appellate?
A lot, because we were essentially defending their cases on appeal quite often, and so they would go with us. Help us prepare, help us learn the record, second seat us on oral argument. So we definitely work closely with the Division of Enforcement and the regional office in arguing their cases.
Okay. Any other cases stand out? You talked about SEC versus Lowe.
Unfortunately, I left that cheat sheet at home.
That's okay. So you said that it was about an 8-year period in which you were essentially doing this appellate work.
Right.
You were getting all the best cases that were...
I think so.
would the commission decide this? Would Ferrara decide this?
The commission decided all litigation questions, what cases we would appeal, and what cases we would go in as amicus. And so the first step... You really wrote your brief when you wrote your memo to the commission explaining why we should appeal, why we should participate, and what theory we would take. And then you know, that usually took you right up to the time your brief was due. So you spent took an all-nighter to turn that into a brief that you would file with the court.
So if you could convince the commission, you were already a good part of the way there.
That's right.
Did you ever have to go actually and sit down before the commission and talk about what you wanted to do in some particular case?
Absolutely. And some of those were very heated, particularly in the Williams Act area, because the Reagan White House wanted a very laissez-faire approach to tender offers. And so to the extent we wanted to argue anything regulatory, it really was a push. And we had to convince, by then it was Chairman Shad, that this was the right way to go. So we had some very late night meetings with the SEC on some of these cases. One of the cases was Hanson Trust versus SCM Corp. It was sort of the street sweep phenomenon where a bidder, in the facts on Hanson, was the bidder got blocked because the target did a final white knight and placed 25% of its stock with the target. The bidder announced his calling off his tender offer, had a three martini lunch with his lawyers and advisors, went back to the market, saw the market dive after that news, and just swept the sweet street. Went to all the ARBs and bought up all the stock. And at that point, they bought up, like, I forget the exact facts, but 25-30%. So they couldn't, they had a blocking position to the White Knight's blocking position, and to just to negotiate something.
Was that chance or was that strategy?
That was strategy. Well, that was a dispute of fact, whether when they called it off, they really meant to call it off,
yeah.
or it was just opportunistic in the afternoon that the stock was presented to them. But the argument was, you know, can this be enjoined as an illegal tender offer? Did they really not truthfully call it off? And there was always this tension. You know, the Act contemplated that there wasn't any limit to how much you could acquire in the market as long as you did in ordinary market transactions. It was only when you did a, quote, tender offer that you had to comply with the filing and disclosure and procedural rules that apply to the tender offer transaction. And so for us to argue that, yes, there is a basis to conclude that the market sweep was really a tender offer was tough to get through the commission.
Did it get through?
Yes, we argued it. And Eventually, the court didn't buy it. The Second Circuit took a very literal approach and said the offer was over and they are free to buy. And they only dealt with sophisticated purchasers, and borrowing some concepts from the Securities Act, they said when you're dealing with just sophisticated people, they don't need the protections of the tender offer rules, so you're free to buy with them. Problem with that is that the Securities Act doesn't have an all holders equal treatment concept. Tender offer rules do, and allowing you just to deal with sophisticated buyers, I mean sellers, and people tendering to the bidder, violates that all holders equal treatment concept.
So if Hanson had bought something from widows and orphans, they would have done better.
That's right.
Okay. What were the... It sounds like that one was... I mean, you got that one through John Shad and the commission.
Right.
It seems like it would have been fairly easy on the face of it, given the interesting circumstances. What was your batting average as far as given that there was this hesitancy on the regulatory side and it was all about insider trading? What was your batting average as far as getting these tender offer cases through the commission?
Fairly good, because we stuck to the basic disclosure concepts of the securities laws, and the arguments we made were, the Act calls for disclosure. Once you make full disclosure, then you're pretty much that's it. We, quite frankly, the positions we took weren't, we're on the conservative side, that we didn't say no, that someone caught making inadequate disclosure in their 13D had to sell all their stock immediately and promise not to buy their stock for another 10 years. That's what the issuers want us to say. But we said no. Make disclosure, maybe a little cooling off period, and then you start all over again. We did say really egregious situations where, like, they blocked a possible competing bid by failing to disclose their position as they required under 13D. Maybe that would be an appropriate case for order of disenfranchisement or disgorgement, but that was very much in the equitable powers of the court to decide.
Was the staff conscious of sort of not going too far? Was there any disjuncture between the staff and the commission from your perspective?
We know what the issues were, and the Hansen case was probably the hardest one to go up and argue and get it through. And I haven't read the brief in a long time, but it was very much not taking a position on the merits, not taking a position on the facts, but if the court were to find these type of circumstances, they could conclude that it was all one tender offer. And so it's, in that sense, since we didn't take a strong position on particular outcome in that case, we didn't win or lose, and the court ruled the other way, although I think the staff never was happy with the reasoning of the Second Circuit in that case.
Hmm. Well, now, you had an interesting switch, because it appears that you went into Corp Fin after the general counsel's
office? Yeah, and my experience in litigating the Williams Act got me into Corp Fin. Linda Quinn, I guess she replaced John Huber as the division director. She recruited Elise Walter from Corp Fin, and I had worked with Elise on the appellate teams in the general counsel's office.
Okay.
At least his name is not being mentioned for commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And so she and Linda recruited me down to head the office, what was then called the Office of Tender Offers, is now called the Office of Mergers and Acquisitions.
Okay.
And I came right into the office as an office division, as an office head, running the office office of tender offers.
How long had that Office of Tender Offers been around?
At least since the mid 70s, maybe a little bit, or I would say the mid 70s. Really, when the 13DG rules came out, the Williams Act was adopted in 68, but I don't think they set up a dedicated office until early mid 70s.
Okay. But the Williams Act is the thing that put all this in business, I guess.
That's right.
Okay.
I guess I was the third head of it. There was a woman named Ruth Applegate, Appleby, who was the first head, and then Joe Connolly was after that, and I replaced him. That was 86.
Mm-hmm.
Joined the commission in 78, and in 86 I went to Corp Fin.
Had you worked closely with this office in your position?
Yes. When we would argue Williams Act cases, they would review the briefs and help us form the position and the arguments.
Okay. So, did your perspective change at all when you went from the general counsel's office to Corp Fin? You're looking at things from a slightly different place.
One of the things that attracted me to the move is that every litigator worries that they don't really know anything. They're just litigators and no practical, marketable experience. So one of the things that attracted me is that I would, become an M&A lawyer. And so that was interesting. So the whole regulatory approach was somewhat at odds to me. As a litigator, you are really constrained by, what the law is and legislative history and judicial precedent. Regulators tend to take a little more leeway and say, well, we think this is the way it should be. Let's write the rule to say that, or let's issue a telephone interpretation that says that, regardless, of the support for it. So I probably represented a very conservative approach, and if I had any run-ins with the staff in the division, it was more, well, wait a minute, what's the basis for taking that position? Yes, I know you've taken that position before, but what's the basis for that position? So I did come down with somewhat of a questioning attitude about whether we really had a basis for some of the positions we were taking.
So your legal experience kept your feet on the ground, so
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Were you involved in rulemaking at this point? Is that what your office was doing?
At that time, the office was barely weekly staffed. I think when I got down there, there were two people there. Mm. Brad Belt was special counsel, and I was appointed chief. But we oversaw the special counsels in each of the operating groups in Division of Corporation Finance. So if there was a tender offer for a manufacturing company, the special counsel in the AD group that oversees the manufacturing companies helped us on the tender offer, and we worked with them. Eventually, that was all shifted internal to the Office of Tender Offers, and so we had our own staff attorneys and special counsels in that group. And I think it was 6 years, 80, maybe it was 9 years, 86 to 93, I guess. It was eventually expanded to proxy matters and proxy contests as well. So anything change of control orientated was handled by the Office of Tender Offers, which is why it eventually became mergers and acquisitions, because it was much more in tender offers.
So were you building this office up then? Is that a lot of what you were doing?
Absolutely. I think at one point we may have grown to about 8 to 10 people, rotating some people in, some permanent staff. But when the Quinn's goal was, one, to get a good core of rule lawyers there, because it was obvious to her that she's going to be writing rules in the Williams Act and proxy area. And
why was it obvious to her?
Because it was a hot area. This was the hostile junk bond breakup, leverage buyout, Nabisco, Boesky, Milken era.
Right.
So this was number one topic for the division. And there are a lot of litigation going on and a lot of issues that need to be addressed by rulemaking.
Okay. So it sounds like Linda Quinn really gave you a mandate. She says, we're going to beef this office up and I want you to develop it.
Right.
So you started by getting a core of rulemaking lawyers.
That's right.
What came next after that?
It was a real fun time for me, because every 2 years or so, the whole focus changed, because the markets changed and the issues changed. And I think we started off focusing on things like the going private rules, 13D3. It was newly adopted in the late 80s. I think 79 is when it became final. It was later than that. It was like early. It's like 84, 85 that came final. But you can check that.
Yeah.
And we had to figure out how to actually make it work and develop positions. And the market had changed. It was written for the typical controlling shareholder, brought his company public in year one when the market was high, and year two the market dives and it buys back his minority interest that he sold to the public. That was really what the rule was written against, but then quickly developed into the leveraged buyout model, where there was private equity firms, mm-hmm. starting with KKR, and then others grew quickly, developed a new way of bringing the company private. But the private equity firms weren't managers. They definitely brought management along as essentially partners in the buyout. And so the big challenge in the early years of 13E3 was how to apply it to leverage buyouts when you know that management was really part and parcel of the transaction, and that's really what the rule is about, when an affiliate is buying out the public shareholders. So developing policies about applying the concept of affiliate to these leverage buyout structures was very challenging at that time.
And you mentioned that you didn't have to just sort of look at the legal nuts and bolts. You could take a sort of policy view and figure out,
right,
this is what we want to accomplish.
And we had to, because we had a rule that wasn't written at a time this structure was in play, this market structure was in place. So we had no guidance from the commission or something from Congress about how do you apply a rule that says when an affiliate participates in a going private transaction that you have to comply with all these additional disclosure rules. And so what does it mean to have an affiliate participate? So we developed positions back then that are current, still being applied by the staff, and they're pretty much doctrine for the M&A practice.
And these positions, they were just to get more disclosure?
The rules the commission adopted to address the guy who sold high and bought low the goal was to get more disclosure about the fairness of the transaction. Very much a federalism issue there, that the securities laws are federal securities laws are disclosure, state law imposes fiduciary duties and ensures substantive fairness, not federal law. And so the 13E3 is the going private rule. It's designed to ensure that shareholders have adequate disclosure to assess whether the board and management were meeting their fiduciary duties under state law to provide us a fair price.
Okay. And you talked about going into this because this is the big era of M&A, Michael Milken and all that stuff's right. happening. How much were you able to anticipate what was going on, or did you come in at the tail end of something that had already played itself out?
I think we were on top of it. I can't say we anticipated, but. The rulemaking, I think, tended to lag because rulemaking takes a lot of time. But in terms of developing positions, the enforcement actions that were brought in those days, which we played a role in, certainly just as general counsel consults with CorpFin when they write briefs, enforcement consults with CorpFin when they bring cases. So it's a big part of what we did was liaisoning with enforcement on some of those cases. I think they're pretty much on top of it. We are certainly helped by the adversarial nature of those issues. There's always two sides to all of them, and both sides will be in our door as soon as the issue pops, telling us which way we should go. Issuers certainly alerted us to something they thought was a problem, and because they wanted us to beat up on the insurgents or the hostile bidders.
All right. You either chaired or managed an advisory committee on capital formation?
After 93, I was promoted essentially up and out of tender offers. I was made an associate director of CorpFin. It was an SES position, but the title was senior legal advisor to the director, who was still in the Quinn at the time.
An SES position?
Senior executive service position.
Oh, okay.
So I was promoted out of my manager position to senior executive position. That was in 93. I still had substantial responsibility for advising on tender offer matters. I was getting Kathy Dixon was my replacement, and we certainly consulted a lot in ongoing projects and issues. Mm-hmm. But I did two main things in that position. One was Arthur Levitt's municipal security push, both in terms of rulemaking. I wrote an interpretive release on municipal security disclosure, essentially a guide to municipal issuers how to avoid engaging in fraudulent conduct. And then I wrote rules on municipal security continuous disclosure to the markets, just like a corporate issuer has to do 10-Ks and 10-Qs to keep the markets current on the developments. Up until that point, once a municipal issuer went to market and sold its securities, it never had to go back and update its offering circular. So we did that. It was all arising out of the Orange County problems back at that time in the early 90s. I worked a lot on the Orange County enforcement matter. I spent a lot of time in Orange County working with the LA staff on that investigation and enforcement matters.
And, okay, this is before you were in the advisory committee, I guess, Orange County.
I think that the two overlapped a lot, but the municipal securities push was before I was assigned to help Commissioner Lawman on the advisory committee.
Okay. Give me a little background on that Orange County municipal issue, because I was really interested in how this municipal thing kind of flared out, and you got a lot of pushback, I know, on various.
Yeah, well, it's very much a keen interest of Chairman Levitt when he got there, given his fund. His father was the controller of New York State, and he grew up professionally in New York, and he did a lot of bond work when he was a dealer in New York, and he knew what the games were. One of his big pushes was to end pay to play by dealers. And then when Orange County ran into trouble, that was like the second big scandal for municipal issuers in 10 years. The first one was New York City about 10 years earlier. He took advantage of that to try to get a little bit more, you know, disclosure into the municipal securities markets. And the two main tools he used was an interpretive release explaining that municipal issuers do have a obligation to inform the markets of material developments, and then codifying that, essentially creating up information repositories that require issuers to put in annual and periodic reports to, so the markets could follow developments at the issuers when, as they were trading the securities.
Right, and those are interesting. Were those creatures of the municipalities, or did the SEC create those repositories?
They were creatures of the municipalities. We said you can meet. The SEC only had jurisdiction over the dealers, not the municipalities. Congress didn't want federal regulation of local officials. Mm-hmm. So we used slightly creative. We essentially said it's fraudulent for a registered broker-dealer to bring a municipal securities issue to market unless it gets promises by the issuer that they will make information available to the market on an ongoing basis by depositing the information into these third-party, essentially private repositories. We either said you could use a private repository or the states could set up a repository, and some states have done that.
Was there much pushback on that?
Oh, sure. it was an interesting time. And it was great because one thing I'll always remember about my career at the SEC, that it just constantly changed. And just to be thrown into something like that and having to learn a whole new market and new rules and new players was just so challenging. One of the reasons I stayed there for 21 years is that every time I thought about leaving, I got an assignment like that, and it was just thrilling.
It sounds like some of this municipal bond regulation, though, was a matter of chance because Arthur Levitt was
exactly.
Where he
yeah,
was.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you get the cities and counties saying, you know, why all of a sudden are you jumping on us? Why do we have to go through all of this?
A bit. I remember doing panels to try to educate people on what we're doing and why we're doing it, and getting arguments like, why do you want us to put out bad information? It's just going to hurt the value of the securities to our holders. It's going to hurt our investors because they won't be able to sell it for as much once we put out our bad information. So we had a bit of educating to do about the benefits of transparency and efficient markets.
So they've been left alone so long.
That's
they haven't
right.
really
yeah.
thought about it much.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that this specialty, this that you'd learned this in the Corp Fin Office of Tender Offers, I guess. Despite the name, you were working on these municipal bond issues?
No. That was a whole new assignment, new life.
Okay. So
I was out of tender offers. I was now the senior legal advisor to the director and one of the first major policy. And the goal of that was to get a bright policy guy freed up to do nothing but head policy teams and do special projects.
Okay.
So that's
gotcha.
What that position was about. And my first job was like the day Arthur Levitt walked in the door was to work on municipal securities disclosure.
Hmm. And was that when Chris Wallman, Commissioner Wallman?
Commissioner Wallman. That was probably 2 years. I said probably 93 I left tender offers and went got this new position. I probably started pretty much right then into municipal securities. And then as that wound down, I wound up into the advisory committee, which was probably late 94, 95
okay.
focus. But for quite a while, a substantial overlap between okay. the two projects, particularly the rulemaking that was done probably in a year, 18-month period, and then the investigation lasted another 6 months to a year. maybe during the investigation period is when I was really doing both at the same time.
Okay.
Commissioner Lawman was very interested in some of the issues facing the capital markets, principally the new issue market, and the somewhat antiquated concepts that were applied to public offerings of securities, and we're witnessing a lot of stress in those markets because the SEC was trying to develop rules and positions that address how private markets can coexist with public markets. It did Rule 144A,
right,
but then adopted a lot of positions about, we started seeing what's now called PIPEs, private offerings by public issuers, because of the difficulty of doing registered offerings and the inability to control timing. Issuers were looking to the private markets to raise capital with a view to doing resales afterwards. And so you had a lot of tension, a lot of what was then called the Securities Act metaphysics.
Securities Act metaphysics?
Metaphysics. Positions being taken by the staff about how you can't mix a private offering with a public offering and gun jumping concerns and a lot of positions that really derailed people for no other reason than to try to maintain some purity of analysis under the Securities Act doctrines that no longer really fit market realities. And that's what the advisory committee started to look into. Was it time to change the paradigm for registration, regulating public offerings of securities to try to kind of meld the public and private markets?
Is that the first time in your career that you felt that that was happening, where the old paradigm wasn't fitting anymore?
The process we jumped into was really somewhat ongoing, but accelerating. Way back at the Wheat Report days, they were talking about the need to coordinate, to reconcile the 33-Act concept and the 34-Act concepts, and then we got into integration systems, disclosure system. But it was just accelerating, and then you started seeing side-by-side public and private offerings, and there was just a lot of tension on the regulatory side, and people getting derailed, getting delayed. The staff is taking some positions that, well, defensible maybe to preserve purity under the Securities Act concept, really indefensible from really a policy point of view. You know, what good does this do anybody to take some of these positions they felt they had to take?
But were these positions causing public issuers to not be able to get out of the market? Is that what it was?
It would delay them. It would prevent them from meeting their immediate cash needs as they ramped up to do a more formal registered offering.
Okay.
Because the staff said you couldn't start marketing privately and then turn it into a public offering. Likewise, you couldn't do a public offering and turn it into a private offering. And those were all issues that people were grappling with, and it just resulted in delays because deals didn't get done till the staff was satisfied that if there was a problem, the problem was fixed. And exacerbated the tendency to avoid, whenever possible, doing a registered public offering with the full protections of the Securities Act, including the disclosure and liability provisions, and doing most of your capital raising in the private markets because it was quicker and less regulatory.
So you were seeing the private markets grow aggressively at this point.
Absolutely. And that's something Commissioner Lawman didn't think made much sense. His concept was to build on a concept known as issuer registration, not register a particular issuance. And so every time an issuer wanted to go to market, it had to go through the whole process all over again and witness the delays and uncertainties in getting to market. But that once a company got registered, once it was reviewed and reviewed on a regular basis through its 34 Act reporting rather than its 33 Act prospectus, then it could go to market any time it wanted. That was a concept that had been around a while, and Commissioner Wallman and the advisory committee really developed it and came out with some proposals. It was really a catalyst to get the SEC firmly behind securities offering reform as a legitimate project, something worth doing. And, you know, immediate reaction to the advisory committee report were concept releases on securities offering reform, which I worked on as well. Regulatory simplification proposals that Commissioner Leavitt pushed through. Eventually, the aircraft carrier, which was Commissioner Leavitt's shot at and Brian Lane's shot at adopting some of these concepts, but eventually got done 2 years ago, 3 years ago, in 2005, with the securities offering reform. Mm-hmm. The concept of WKSIs that can go to market anytime they want.
WKSIs?
Well-known seasoned issuers, WKSI, which are this, essentially the issuers, registered issuers, who don't have to worry about the registration process anymore when they want to go to market. So a lot of the projects I did that I was working on when we start talking about international, which will just be obvious as well, when I left the commission in late 99, really didn't get done until 2005, 2006, 2007. The reason for that is Sarbanes-Oxley, and they preoccupied the commission for a 3 or 4 year period in between. And so it's interesting, just now, everything that I was working on when I left the commission is finally being put in place.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
This, the WKSIs, the thing you just described working on, this sounds like the kind of rationale behind shelf registration as well.
Right. Well, shelf registration was one of the early attempts to address this problem, but it had significant limitations. But shelf registration built on the notion of one, integrating the 33 Act and 34 Act reporting schemes, and two, letting the seasoned issuers go to market without SEC review. That once you're registered, you could do that. So the issuer registration was really an expansion of shelf registration to a broader types of companies, to not a straitjacket in terms of, you know, specific number of securities to be offered, specific type of securities to be offered, specific type of offering. All that had to be spelled out in the base registration for you to be able to do a subsequent transaction. And that was the kind of straitjackets that didn't always work.
So it just is your perspective that it just takes a lot of time for these things to work through the system?
Oh, absolutely.
For people to
absolutely.
Buy in?
And you need something like a free thinker like Commissioner Wallman and a project like the advisory committee report to shake things up and get these projects on the agenda.
What was it about Commissioner Wallman that gave him this free thinking perspective?
Just that kind of guy, I guess.
Yeah.
He was definitely willing to challenge many of the staff assumptions. He was similar to the approach I took, I guess. I know you've taken that position for quite a while, but why?
Right.
What's the basis for it? What good are you doing? Who are you serving? And he raised those questions, both on the regulatory side and the enforcement side as well.
Did you work closely with him?
Absolutely. I was the senior staffer on the project. And so, you know, with his guidance, we set up an agenda to hold meetings, to interview market participants, to put out draft reports, and position papers, and eventually draft the final report.
Who worked with you on that group?
Meredith Cross, I liaisoned with. What was her maiden name? She's still in the general counsel's office. Oh, shit.
We can get it later.
Kathy Dixon. Louise Welby.
These Corp Fin people?
Everybody was Corp Fin except for Meredith. She was the general counsel liaison.
Okay.
And the other people we dealt with and, you know, work closely with, well, it was mainly Meredith Cross and Corp Fin. And that was about it.
How long did the process take?
About 18 months.
So you released a report?
Right.
Were you conscious of being in the tradition of all these great SEC studies?
Yeah, if you read it, we give the history and we say, where are we fitting in? And we say, this has all been thought about and proposed before. Now it's time to do it. And here it is. We try to make it sound as least radical as possible to get it done. But
give it some inevitability, I guess.
That's right.
And when did it come out?
I think the report came out probably early 96.
Okay.
I think. Actually, it might actually be here. The concept for release, which followed the report to try to get public input, was July of 96. I guess the report was actually in May of 96.
Okay. What was the reception like?
It was very favorable in the bar and the insurer community. That is definitely something to be done. And when Commissioner Leavitt heard that, got that feedback, that's what convinced him he could try to do the what Brian Lane dubbed, gave the unfortunate name of the aircraft carrier.
Right.
What was ill-fated attempt at implementing the proposals. And the problem was, you know, the thing was this thick, and it was just more of the same regulatory, try to define by rule how to free up the capital raising process. And maybe it was too ambitious, maybe it was too regulatory, too complicated. It was Alan Bella's genius 8 years later to do a much more simple proposal, straightforward proposal.
Alan?
Beller.
Beller.
Yeah, who is okay. Who followed David Martin as division director and eventually got the securities offering reform done.
So the aircraft carrier was sort of trying to bring in new substance but using the same old form, I guess?
Yeah, it took on too much. Some of the things that did propose got done sooner than securities offering reform, so bringing it up helped get some of the concepts done. So one of the things that was a problem was just too much at once, and secondly, it was a very detailed, complicated regulatory approach to the concepts.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've touched on everything but the international issues. I definitely want to... You mentioned that those had really, you know, come on your radar screen periodically throughout your career with the SEC.
Right. I think back in my general counsel days, one of my non-litigation projects was working on the restatement on international foreign relations law with the... providing SEC comments on the Alley American Law Institute drafts of the restatement of international relations law, the whole concept of extraterritorial jurisdiction, long-arm jurisdiction, applications of the federal securities laws to foreign transactions and ability to sue in the United States for cross-border transactions.
Who had promulgated these? You were commenting on another organization.
The American Law Institute is I guess it's an association mainly of law professors.
Okay.
And they come up with these restatements of law, which they draft as both a codification of existing law, but also somewhat of a model law, as it might exist on the state and federal level. And it's really their expert advice to the state and federal legislators about, you know, how to best way to address the problem. And so when they were coming up with guidelines on international law that could affect both the commission and private plaintiffs' ability to bring an action for securities law violations based against foreign companies and foreign market participants, that was certainly of concern to the commission. And so we would comment on the concepts in there about when it's appropriate for a U.S. court to assert jurisdiction over either cross-border or extraterritorial conduct. So it was a very interesting project.
Was this in the late 70s, early 80s?
Early 80s.
Okay. It would seem that was fairly early to be concerned about.
Definitely. And I think it was the second restatement, so it wasn't the first part, but the initiation of it. But it was definitely, this is when the commission was starting to see insider trading problems going cross-border. Mm-hmm. And we had to develop remedies for freezing assets in the United States for when the people doing the trading were offshore. We started to see more and more U.S. Investment in the United States by foreign entities, so you had securities transactions taking place in the United States. Foreign issuers are starting to list in the United States, and so one of the questions was, to what extent could a U.S. investor get a remedy for fraudulent conduct? So that's what that about.
The American Law Institute, it sounds like they were pushing this.
Yes, to modernize the law.
Okay. Rather than the SEC.
Yes, we were pushing it by bringing enforcement actions and saying freeze the bank accounts and brokerage accounts of John Doe 1-2-10,
right,
who were foreign traders who traded ahead of breaking news in our markets. And
right,
we were figuring out at the SEC new ways to assert our control over transactions that have both U.S. and foreign elements. And so when the ALI was going to speak to those issues and come out with a restatement of law that the courts would look to for guidance, we wanted to make sure that they got it right.
Okay. Did this go to issues of accounting?
To a certain extent. It was more jurisdiction. When can a court assert jurisdiction? But to the extent it went to fraudulent accounting, yes. It made distinctions between what was appropriate for a government agency to assert regulatory jurisdiction. Say, for example, you must register with the SEC and you must start filing reports with the SEC, including complying with the United States GAAP principles, versus fraudulent concepts. When investors are harmed in the United States, we have a right to go after you no matter where in the world you are. And certainly the fraud jurisdiction, everybody recognized, should be broader than the regulatory jurisdiction. And those are the type of concepts that the restatement addressed.
Was the focus mostly on the fraud jurisdiction?
Yes, I think that was a principal concern. But we wanted to make clear that that was a distinction, and that while we recognize there are reasonable limits to the extent the SEC could force everybody in the world to register with them and use U.S. GAAP, we felt pretty strongly that both the SEC and private plaintiffs should be able to haul foreign issuers, foreign market participants into court for fraudulent conduct that impacts the U.S. markets.
It's pretty clear that the Shad Commission, really made some headlines with the MOUs, that sort of thing.
Right.
And this is part of the insider
trading.
Was there any other concern about the regulatory side, about what became the dominant issues later, which is the competitiveness of U.S. markets and the ability of foreign issuers to use U.S. markets?
At that stage, no. It was still very much enforcement focus. Inside trading was a big concern. At that time, to encourage U.S. listings by foreign companies, and so we didn't have to, they would submit themselves to jurisdiction in the United States. There was a move at Corp Fin to develop a foreign issuer reporting system that would make reasonable accommodations to foreign issuers that want to address coming to the United States, but still holding the line on basics like U.S. financial statements. Well, at some at that time, some people were arguing that no, it should be comedy, and if you have a public company in England, they should be able to come in and be a public company here based on their English documents. You know, Donaldson, when he was running the New York Stock Exchange, that's what he was arguing for. But the SEC bent a little, but still held the line that no, if you want to list and access U.S. investors, you have to comply with U.S. rules with reasonable accommodations, and the accommodations were mostly in the corporate governance, internal affairs areas than the capital markets areas.
Was there anyone in the SEC raising the possibility of revisiting this, you know, and maybe allowing reciprocity between different regulatory regimes?
Yes, absolutely. And that gets me into when I moved into tender offers.
Okay.
Throughout my period there, cross-border acquisitions was certainly an issue I was focusing on because you're forced to deal with them. By that time, there was enough cross-border investment that virtually any transaction, you can find investors who you need to buy the shares from to acquire that company in multiple jurisdictions. So it became more and more of an issue. How do you do one transaction, but you buy from multiple jurisdictions? And our focus was mainly a UK company wants to buy a Canadian company that has both Canadian and US and Australian shareholders. What do you do about the US shareholders? And we have these tender offer rules. How do you comply with several sets of rules at the same time? And certainly if you're going to buy the company for shares and offer shares into the United States, that implicates the 33 Act securities registration issue, including the reporting and U.S. GAAP financial reporting issues. So potentially if you wanted to buy if a Canadian company wanted to buy a Canadian company that had a handful of U.S. shareholders, you have the potential of having to be a U.S. reporting company. The first step in that process, the first real project I worked on was the Multi-Jurisdictional Disclosure System, MJDS,
right,
which was not limited to tender offers. It was limited to cross-border financings as well, public offerings. But it was the notion that the Canadian system was being developed very much along the same lines as the U.S. system. It was maturing, the regulators were becoming more efficient and more sophisticated. At some point, the Commission should get comfortable that their rules were as good as ours, and if you comply with Canadian rules for a transaction that was essentially Canadian-centered, then you wouldn't have to also comply with U.S. rules.
Where did the impetus for this come from? Who came up with this idea?
I think it was probably the Canadians pushed the idea,
and
we explored with it. It was a very awkward model because it really depended on a detailed examination of each country's laws and the conclusion that the laws are very similar and adequate. And, you know, while that might have been possible at that time with U.S. and Canada, it proved to be the wrong model going forward because you could never do that on a true multi-jurisdictional basis. On a bi-jurisdictional basis, yes, but not on a multi-jurisdictional basis. So the name was a bit of a misnomer.
Hmm. Wasn't the UK supposed to be involved at some point?
Yeah, early on, that was the thought. But very much Linda Quinn spearheading these type of projects went to a different approach. But MJDS had the concept that if less than 40% of shareholders are in the United States, if you were going to do a public offering or tender offer for a Canadian company and comply with Canadian law, then you did not also have to comply with U.S. law. And that was a big project, a big groundbreaker. But it still wasn't enough. It was quite common for any type of cross-border acquisition to exclude U.S. holders from participating. So if a U.K. company was buying a Swiss company, on the face of the offering doc was saying, this offer is not extended into the United States. The courts upheld that, saying that it was reasonable because of the regulatory burdens of, particularly in a share deal, extending the offering to the United States, that they could say that, no, we won't make the offering to the United States. It was tested a couple of times. In one case, Goldfield Mines in the Second Circuit, they said, well, when you reasonably anticipate that foreign custodians will send their documents to U.S. investors, and then you're subject to at least fraud jurisdiction in the United States. And then so everybody marked up their documents prohibiting U.K. custodians from sending their documents into the United States. But in most part, the courts, and to a certain extent the SEC, recognized that because of the implications of formally extending an offer, including particularly an offer to sell securities into the United States, had significant regulatory costs, is a better part to just to respect that, to saying that, okay, the offer is not made into the United States. And that left U.S. investors essentially to scramble. One, they didn't get the documents directly, so they really had no idea what was going on. And two, if they wanted to participate, they had two choices. One, to sell into the markets and take advantage of the premium built into the market reflecting the announcement of an acquisition, but they couldn't get the full price offered in the transaction because they couldn't participate directly because they were excluded. That was great for the international arbs who would buy up all the U.S. shares and transfer them to the offshore and then tender over there. And so the SEC started exploring ways to facilitate that. It was mainly this, because, again, you have to take your shareholders where you find them when you're doing an acquisition or a rights offering. Rights offering are much more common in Europe and other countries than the United States. You have this problem of you have to take your shareholders where you find them. You can always do a public offering and say, I'm only going to hire dealers and underwriters in this country and distribute it in this country, and you get fairly good control over where the shares are going. But when you want to buy another company that already has an international shareholder base, you're kind of stuck with what you have. So we tried to develop rules, and this was another decade-long project, to allow cross-border transactions and define when it made more sense for the SEC just to step aside and allow the whole transaction to take place under the foreign laws, rather than say, no, if you dare to extend your offer formally into the United States, we're going to make you register, we're going to make you file tender offer documents in the United States. And then we did that without doing the type of analysis we did in Canada under MJDS and saying, okay, we're happy with UK, but we're not happy with France and Italy, forget about it. We didn't want to do that. So we wanted to come up with rules that we could live really regardless of the level of regulation by the home country. And that was what eventually became the cross-border tender offer and rights offering rules. And just to give you an idea of the bare-bones requirements, that if you can determine that less than 5% of the public shareholders are in the United States, then you're free. You can mail into the United States. You can offer securities to U.S. holders. Just treat our guys the same way you treat your guys. Give them the same disclosure. Give them the same right to participate, the same economics. If you're over that level, we proposed 5%. We eventually adopted 10%. And then, if it was a share deal, you would have to register. But by then, the registration requirements, the foreign issuer disclosure and registration system had developed a bit, that it wasn't so onerous for foreign issuers to come in. By that time, we have significant experience of foreign issuers listing in the United States and registering. So it wasn't that unreasonable to say that if you already have 10% of the target shareholders in the United States, there's a significant enough focus in the United States, we think it's worthwhile that you register the shares you're offering in the transaction. In share deals, in practice, that has had mixed results. It is still very, very common to take the "we're not extending this offer into the United States" approach to avoid registering the transaction. Yeah,
they have to register just like any U.S.
Right.
company would have to register.
Yes. If company A wants to buy public company B and do it, that by nature is going to be a public transaction because they're dealing with public shareholders, and wants to offer shares, then company A has to register those shares with the SEC before they offer them to company B shareholders. And if a foreign acquirer wants to offer its foreign shares to either a U.S. company or another foreign company, but it happens to have U.S. shareholders, the same problems arise.
Okay. And then you had something like two or three tiers where there's a 40%
But that's in the cash context. If you go over to 10%, you're going to have to comply with the 33 Act, but you know all the accommodations that were made for foreign registrants were there. And then we made some accommodations, additional accommodations in the, under the tender offer rules between the 10 and 40% range. Essentially, we were dealing with this on an ad hoc basis through no action letters, dealing with deal counsel to give them the relief they needed to extend the offer into the United States. Very much the scenario was someone would call us up saying, you know, we're going to tell you we're going to do this offer. Example was Ford buying Jaguar, and then there were a couple others as well at the same time. We can't do this offer under three jurisdictions at the same time because all the rules conflict at different timetables, different disclosure levels. We really got to exclude the U.S. shareholders. And the SEC would push back right before, you can't exclude the U.S. shareholders. And so we worked through no action letters and interpretive advice to help them accommodate the different regulatory requirements of the different jurisdictions, essentially have the offer occur simultaneously in the several jurisdictions. And that worked. And so we experimented by no action letters, interpretive letters, and to find out, you know, what was necessary to allow these offers, particularly cash deals now, to be extended in multiple jurisdictions. And that's, we essentially codified all that relief for persons in between the 10 and 40% range to allow the offers to take place simultaneously in different jurisdictions. That's what the Tier 2 is. Then above 40%, you're back under the ad hoc approach. This thing is, you know, half in the United States. We think you should comply with our rules, but if you have a real problem, we'll see if we can accommodate you and come and talk to us. Mm-hmm. And that's still been a very active practice for many lawyers and the SEC staff.
Were you in Associate Director of International Finance
at
this point?
After my stint as the big policy guy as a senior legal advisor, after the advisory committee. And again, these things didn't have clear cuts. By about a six-month overlap there, I was appointed Associate Director for International Corporate Finance. That was in 96, I think early 96.
Okay, and this is within CorpFin?
In CorpFin, right.
Yeah. Okay.
And again, my role is principally policymaking and rulemaking. I was given responsibility for overseeing the office of International Corporate Finance, which is the operational office that actually facilitated foreign companies making filings with the SEC, coming in and listing, and so that they handled the filings. And my goal, my main, and Paul Dudek headed that office then, as he does now. And he reported to me, and so I oversaw that office, but I also did the projects. I was both at straight SEC rulemaking in the international area, as well as working on the IASCO projects as well. I was on the working party number one for international corporate finance issues, including international disclosure and accounting standards. And other working parties, the special project by IASCO for internet matters.
Tell me about, let's step back and talk a little bit about those.
Okay.
And your involvement with IASCO through the commission. I mean, this is when we're getting to what's going on internationally, clearly how the SEC is relating to IASCO is pretty important.
Sure.
Can you sort of set that up when you first started dealing with IASCO? What was the relationship like?
The working party had already been around a bit. Linda Quinn took a significant interest in it and really got it set up and got the process going, where the regulators, representatives from major markets would meet. It's actually quite often, at least quarterly, if not more. and work on projects which we've come up with a recommendation to all the jurisdictions on how to better integrate the markets. My focus was CorpFin and disclosure matters, but there were also working parties for market regulation, trading practice issues, investment management issues, and enforcement issues.
These are IOSCO working parties?
Right, right.
Okay.
And the main focus of the Corporation Finance Working Party was international disclosure standards and international accounting standards to facilitate cross-border public offerings and listings. Mm-hmm. And the disclosure side of it, we did. We came up with a template for non-financial reporting disclosure that could be used by several jurisdictions to allow you to list in several countries. And we reformed the SEC forms. So we put out rules to adopt those standards as the SEC standards that it applies to foreign companies coming to list in the United States. And so that's quite significant. We essentially came up with a common set of disclosure principles, level of disclosures for companies wanting to list in the IOSCO markets, and then we went ahead and adopted it. We were the first jurisdiction to adopt it.
The U.S.
The U.S.
Who came up? The IOSCO working group came up with these rules.
Right. They issued a paper essentially saying, we think these are the standards that are necessary and appropriate to demand of a non-resident company wanting to list cross-border in a host country jurisdiction.
So you worked with regulators from different countries.
Absolutely.
Do you remember who the ones who were really pushing things, who had the good ideas?
The UK, France, Italy was very active. It was mainly Europeans, but we also had Japanese. Were there in the other Pacific? Oh, certainly Australian. They were great. Canadian.
You remember any important people that you worked with?
I wish I did. No, I can't remember names.
Okay.
If it's important, I can maybe try to go through my cards. And
yeah, that's okay.
Notes.
But the
names will be on those reports from back then.
Yeah, I've heard that, the U.S. being, the big gorilla in the room tended to drive things.
Yeah, and maybe that's changed now, but that certainly was the case then.
Okay.
It was all, particularly on the accounting side, it was all, what can we get the SEC to accept? Okay. The main work product on the accounting side was commenting on draft standards published by the International Accounting Standards Board. And so IOSCO would come up with its own set of comments as IOSCO on those standards. So the SEC would put in its own standards as SEC, but IOSCO would put them in, and the SEC certainly had a lot to say about what IOSCO said about those proposals. But that was really where the concept of convergence started, and the notion is through this process of improving the international accounting standards, at some point they'll be good enough to be either equal quality, if not totally the same, as the U.S. standards. And that was a fascinating process.
About when was this that you started working on?
96 to when I left in 99. It was well underway when I got there in 96. It already had a year or so of this notion of commenting on the International Accounting Standards. So it was already well underway. But it was still definitely in the meat of it. And one of the last things I did in that area was put out a concept release on international accounting standards. About what would it take for the SEC to eliminate the reconciliation requirement for international accounting standards. And that really was a template, again, for what happened 7 years later, or 6 years later, and 7 years later, in 2007, when they eventually approved it.
I mean, can you trace that directly back? Were all the pieces in there, or most of the pieces concept release?
Yes. I think there may have been a slight varying from the hope of getting identical standards to getting equal quality standards. And there was more of a notion that, well, maybe it shouldn't be the rest of the world coming up and matching FASB. It should be FASB matching the rest of the world. And so the FASB took up a bunch of projects to conform their rules to what was actually better, more state-of-the-art rules being developed by the International Accounting Standards Board. And so that's where the concept of convergence came. It wasn't the rest of the world coming up the SEC standard, the U.S. standards. It was the world converging on best practices. And now it's totally flipped. The idea is, you know, how long do we need FASB? Why, you know, we can't really have dual competing standards. And shouldn't FASB be somewhat rolled into, I guess, maybe the International Accounting Standards Board?
How much, if any, did the crack up in the American accounting business help move this along?
Well, it delayed it for a while because, again, the commission got preoccupied with Sarbanes-Oxley. So a lot of projects were shelved, not only securities offering reform, but international accounting standards as well. Mm-hmm. They would have all gotten done pre-95 if it wasn't for the crack up in Sarbanes-Oxley, because the commission went on a rulemaking binge to implement that on the statutory mandates that took every able body on the staff to get done. So, you know, things still got, groundwork got laid, work got done, but really couldn't throw the resources into making the final pushes until after Sarbanes-Oxley was done with it.
In the international area, were you involved at all in the SEC institutes and efforts to...
Yes.
Can tell me a little bit about those. Who ran them and how they worked?
If I recall, it was Chairman Breeden was one who started them. And Linda Quinn was the driving force in organizing them. And my participation, I guess they were already well in place by the time I took over my international role formally. But the 3 or 4 years I did that, I was certainly key in putting together those each year's programs, and as well as participating as a lecturer and commentator. You're talking about, you know, training other other regulators. So I can't say I was a driving force, but by the time I got directly involved in them, they were fairly well, very sophisticated, well attended programs.
Did you see results from those things?
Oh yes. I think the world markets have benefited greatly from that. Being on the private side and dealing with regulators throughout the world and dealing with my counterparts who administer their rules, in the late 90s, all the major markets reformed their regimes. Some took a slightly different tact and, in a certain sense, leapfrogged the SEC in terms of the best way to approach public offerings and regulatory matters. But that was, I think, could be definitely attributed to those programs, because we really did train the securities regulators of the world.
You talked about people leapfrogging the SEC. Who were the leapfroggers?
I think when, for example, when the EU did its prospectus directive to allow you to be passported to make an offering anywhere in the EU if you qualified in any one jurisdiction, that was both, you know, predated the securities offering reform, and it was probably a little bit more efficient than the current cross-border rules. But, you know, they have a much closer tie than the United States has with any other jurisdiction, so it kind of made sense for them.
Any other activities in the international area that we haven't talked about?
Regus?
Yeah, and 144A?
Right. I didn't adopt Regus. I was still in tender offers when that was done, but when I came into my role as the head of international corporate finance, there was a significant problem with Regus abuses, particularly with U.S. companies selling in what purported to be offshore transactions, but really just parking it offshore with U.S. hedge funds and other investors who would wait the 40 days or so to when that was written into the rules as a compliance period that the shares supposed to come the rest offshore, and then just flip them back into the public markets. Mm-hmm. This is again the part of the balloon squeezing tensions that were occurring when issuers trying to find ways to raise capital on an expedited basis without having to do U.S. public offerings because of the problems and costs of those offerings. And so they would go to these offshore markets, and then these are public companies, listed companies, NASDAQ companies, sell to these private investors offshore who would then immediately sell back into the U.S. markets. And so you have the U.S. markets being flooded with shaky securities that there was a reason that maybe the issuers didn't want to go through the registration process at that particular time. And so there were scandals, and the SEC realized it had to tighten Regulation S. And we did. We put in new rules, particularly governing U.S. companies that try to rely on Reg S to offer shares offshore. And essentially the approach of the rules was to treat Reg S offerings by U.S. companies on the same basis as private placements. Buyer of the securities, in terms of ability to sell back into the United States, would essentially get a restricted securities, which they can only sell either pursuant to a registration statement if the issuer registered for resale in the United States, or have to wait till Rule 144 became available to resell the United States and trickle it back into the public markets that way.
But you had to sell them to established
purchasers,
I guess. Yeah, the word was.
We wouldn't make you comply with the full private offering regimes, no general solicitation, sophisticated investor. You could do essentially what was a public offering offshore, but those offshore buyers got restricted securities. And so they could trade offshore, but if they wanted to bring them back into the United States, and since a lot of these were public companies in the United States, it was a real risk, they could only do that by complying with 144. So essentially, the goal was to shut off the flow back into the United States of these securities.
Did it work?
Yes. It somewhat hamstrung U.S. companies trying to do offers offshore. You may be familiar with some of the transactions taking place on the AIM market of the London Stock Exchange by U.S. companies, so particularly after Sarbanes-Oxley decided to list offshore rather than the United States. And it is quite cumbersome to do that because you're essentially doing a private placement in a public offshore market, and those offshore public investors are trading restricted securities that have legends on them and everything else. It's a very difficult area to practice in because it's just definitely trying to fit the round peg, let's say a square peg of a public offering into the round hole of a private placement restricted securities.
But you can do it if you know what all the rules are.
That's
and
right.
How to
that's
fit
right.
Them.
And deals get done.
Well, you talked about, I mean, it sounds as if these were U.S. companies wanting to do these. They were parking the securities offshore and then bringing them back.
Right.
Right. It sounds as if the vast majority, the bulk of these shares probably weren't dodgy at all. They were probably perfectly good, I would think. And they were just trying to avoid the expense.
That's a fair statement. Just like pipe transactions today. The SEC has done a lot since then, even more to open up the public markets to the smaller companies. But when they're burning cash, it's either lay off people, close your doors, or raise money on an unregulated basis. They either do it on a private placement pipe transaction with a promise to register the resale into the public markets later, or they go offshore and do the same thing.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the office that you're running in international finance. How many folks did you have working with you? You were working, I guess, with IOSCO, working on some rulemaking.
Right. The Office of International Corporate Finance probably had about 5 people staffing it. And I normally would use 1 or 2 of those people on my rulemaking projects as well. But I also went elsewhere in the division and commission for people to help me with the IOSCO projects and other rulemaking projects, either general counsel, the Office of International, International Affairs. There's, by that time, there was a dedicated office to facilitating cross-market that.
So
I worked with them a lot.
Okay. Who was running that office?
What was her name? It was right before Ethiopis got there. It was still there. I should know her name.
We can get that.
Yeah. Sandra Folsom, who was now in that office, was in Corfin at the time, and we worked together extensively on IOSCO matters.
And these are mostly working on these IOSCO, working groups?
Yes.
Okay.
But also the rulemaking to implement it. So we did rulemaking to implement the international disclosure standards. We did rulemaking on the Reg S side. We did another piece of rulemaking on cross-border press releases. Again, to make sure that they could honestly tell a court we stayed offshore, there were no contacts with the United States. If a foreign company wanted to buy another company and held a press conference announcing the bid, they would keep out all the U.S. press.
Right.
So we wrote a rule saying that wasn't necessary. We did the concept releases on international accounting standards. Worked very closely with market regulation as it dealt with its issues on cross-border matters that are now just coming to a head again. They're a little bit behind CorFin, but the idea of reciprocity and those issues were back available then. So, you know, what extent could a foreign electronic market put screens into the United States and allow a broker in the United States to trade foreign securities from the United States on those foreign markets? You know, all of a sudden, every listed company offshore was tradable in the United States without ever complying with the U.S. disclosure requirements or accounting standards. And those issues are still being wrestled with. So I was certainly working with them on that. You will see some of those issues popping up in the releases addressing alternative trading systems.
Anything else that we should talk about that we've missed?
Proxy rules. As I said, when after 87 and the markets died a bit and hostile tender offers might not have been the way to take over a company anymore, you started seeing good old-fashioned proxy contests come back. And you also saw the advent of shareholder activism. You saw it kind of deja vu all over again. In the early 90s, we did executive comp disclosure, and we did proxy reform. So the Office of Tender Offers was given jurisdiction over all proxy contests. And so we commented on materials filed by insurgents and managements and the opposition on election contests and other contests. Quite often they were tied to takeovers, tender offers. By that time, states got smart and managements got smart, and they were backed up by state courts on what type of takeover defenses worked without running afoul of the Constitution, the Commerce Clause. And they were upheld. So you had poison pills, you had state takeover statutes, which really gave the power of management to just say no. But what they did, particularly Delaware, was to leave room to, yeah, management could say no, but shareholders can replace management. And so the tactic shifted to proxy contest to essentially put the takeover to a vote of shareholders and as a way of getting around the board. And so that was natural for Office of Tender Offers to jump into that and start addressing those issues. But the rulemaking we did was more on the shareholder activism side. Before we did rulemaking in 92, if a CalPERS wanted to put out a press release saying that we think the option plan proposed by IBM management is ridiculous, it's overly generous, and we're going to oppose it, they just created a federal crime.
They
committed a federal crime because the proxy rule said that anybody engaged in a proxy solicitation, which meant any communication that would like to lead to anybody granting, withholding, a proxy, was a proxy solicitation and had to be complied with the proxy rules. And the proxy rules made no distinction between management or shareholders or insurgents or different types of communications. And so CalPERS would have had to prepare a proxy statement complying with all the disclosure rules that the SEC would apply to management, file with the SEC 10 days in advance of sending it out, undergo a review process by the SEC, so we need lawyers to interface with the SEC and fix up their document, and then mail this thing out to everybody, all shareholders, because they wanted to do a press release that possibly could reach all shareholders. Mm-hmm. That was absolutely prohibitive. So what we did in 92 was to say, no, you have to draw a distinction between the type of people communicating, between management, certainly on one side when they're putting proposals that they want shareholders to approve, that mm-hmm. makes sense for them to fully comply with all the SEC rules, and insurgents who want to take over the board or want to get out, convince people to give them the power to vote someone else's shares, they should comply more fully with the SEC rules. And the CalPERS and the other activists who just want to express their views on matters being proposed by others, whether it's management's option plan or it's some bidder's takeover, do they favor management or the bidder in this transaction? Why can't CalPERS not only put out a press release, but maybe call up, maybe write a letter to other shareholders saying support the other side? We think that's the better deal. And so we freed them up, essentially said that those type of communications were all subject to the anti-fraud provisions, so you couldn't lie and cheat. But so long as you didn't have a special interest in the matter being voted upon other than as a shareholder, you could just go ahead and communicate. One requirement we had to do to give it some transparency was that if you wrote a letter, for example, anything in writing, and you own more than $5 million in the securities being voted, you just had to send that letter to the SEC. It wasn't reviewed, and the SEC would not comment on it. Mm. It just had to be put in a public place where everybody would be aware of it.
Was this controversial?
Absolutely.
I would think.
Because you expose management to their shareholders, and all right. of a sudden, proxy rules no longer protected management from their shareholders. Without it, you couldn't have shareholder activism today.
Correct.
Because it was absolutely prohibited. But those early 90 rules freed up the activists to communicate with each other about matters being proposed by shareholders. You couldn't have the Joe Grunfest just vote no campaigns because those would have had to be lawyered up and run through the SEC. You have all the printing and mailing expenses of putting out a proxy statement before you could communicate.
Was this something that your office did all on its own, or was this an initiative from the commission?
It was certainly... We're the ones who knew there was a problem, but it wasn't a secret that there was a problem. Breeden was definitely behind it. I think if you ask him today, is one of his proudest... achievements, particularly in his new life as a shareholder activist. he takes full advantage of it. It was a great project. You start to get an idea of why I stayed there 21 years.
Yeah, you did cover a lot of different areas.
That's right.
Well, given all that, what was behind the decision to leave the SEC? Did you feel like you were starting to repeat yourself?
A bit. I think principally it was I had kids in high school and they were facing college, and so I had to figure out how to pay for that.
Heard that one before.
And that's I was driving it, but I probably had run it. You know, it wasn't the first time I thought about leaving and maybe put out some feelers, but every time I seemed to do that every 2 or 3 years, one of these projects landed in my laps and say, you know, forget about it, I'm going to stay a while. But this time I did it more seriously. I didn't think I would be promoted above that. I didn't think I was going to be the next director of corporation finance. So I probably played it out as played the ride out as far as I was going to play it. Mm-hmm.
So your next step, did you come to Morgan
right,
Lewis?
Yep, came right out of here.
And work in, is international finance a specialty for you now?
Very much. One of the things that attracted me here is it was a big firm with a lot of cutting edge work. I had worked, you know, with them over the years on different projects. They're very much involved representing clients or asking for relief or just commenting on things we were doing. So I knew they had the intellectual power here and the practice to allow me to apply what I knew and did, but also learn a whole lot more, and particularly on the transactional side. So it was a great move in that respect. I definitely continued on and kept a presence in the areas, all of them, from international to proxy and shareholder activism matters, and certainly M&A. I worked on all the public M&A deals in this firm. Unfortunately, a lot of the international work these days is advising foreign clients on how not to come into the United States, but very much applying the rules that I developed and got adopted by the SEC. It's a big centerpiece of my practice.
So if you're advising international firms not to come into the United States, it looks like you can't get the square pegs in the round holes.
Well, that would be an example like a rights offering that has more than 5% to 10% in the United States. And uh-huh. It's a choice of either do the, you know, exclude the U.S. or register approach, and it just doesn't make sense to register. So they advise them how to do that, how to control their publicity. Reg S deals are still very common. The whole push of all these companies is a list on the AIM. We've done quite a few of those. It's all those tension areas of, you know, to what extent, you know, what are the rules for being able to claim that your offer satisfies the standards of Reg S and does not trigger U.S. jurisdiction, both on the public offering side or on the acquisition side.
It sounds like some of the things you did back in the 90s, having kicked in the 2000s, that made your job a little bit easier.
Yes, it was fascinating because, you try to keep, it's important to keep up with these developments. I've been active in the ABA and, putting together comment letters for the ABA on SEC proposals, so I was very much involved in the later stages of all those projects I helped generate while I was still on the staff.
All right. Well, thanks for helping me generate this oral history transcription.
Okay.